future. There are no people. There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Everybody, everybody, welcome, welcome. It is Friday, November 12th, 2021. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Each week, I talk to Sean Kitchen, who is, by the way, back at brunch. Sean Kitchen and I talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Yes, you can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Just head on over to patreon.com/rcpress. You can also help out the show by heading on over to our YouTube channel if you're not there already. Smash that subscribe button, like the stream for this show, and hit that notification bell so you know every time we go live, and share it with your friends. You're sitting there right now, share it out. Hey, by the way, did you guys know? Out to Coop's live right now. Yeah, Sean Kitchen, right? Back in the house. Yes. Here we go. On today's show, holy crap, there's a lot of stuff going on. Well, the big roads, bridges, and fossil fuel infrastructure bill passed. And now, drum roll please, it looks like the more important Build Back Better reconciliation bill is on the ropes as fossil fuel industry and corporate-backed Democrats renege on their promises. Surprise, surprise, surprise. Hope you've got your flood and fire insurance updated. Well, and earlier this week, Brian Deese, the director of Biden's National Economic Council, told PBS, "We are confident that this framework will pass the House and will pass the Senate." And that's what we're telling lawmakers. It's an easy vote. Yeah, well, that was Monday. Now it's Friday. And we have no idea what's going to go on. And they're going to try to slowly kill the bill by slowly rolling out the budget stuff, right? What is the assessment of kind of the cost? Why can't I think of the name of that? Anyways, and as COP26 wraps up in Glasgow, Scotland, it is clear that the developed countries are going to rely on magic and wishful thinking to address the climate crisis. According to Climate Action Tracker, only four parties, Chile, Costa Rica, the European Union, and the UK, have any kind of concrete plan to meet their pledges to cut the carbon cord. And while nations, including the United States, have committed to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, current policies put us on track for 2.7 degrees warming. You see the difference there? And guess what? Time's running out. And it's been a banner week for right-wing extremists. Yes, Kyle Rittenhouse puts on a show in an attempt to avoid accountability for killing two people and wounding a third at a Black Lives Matter protest last year in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And at the same time, Republican Representative Paul Gosar of Arizona, tweeted out an altered anime video showing a character with his face killing a character with AOC's face. What kind of repercussions will there be? Right? Unbelievable. Despite the dire warnings from scientists and direct experience with extreme weather, a new Washington Post ABC News poll finds that Americans' views on the threat of climate change remain unchanged in the last 7 years. Yep. And surprise, surprise again, the gap between Democrats and Republicans has only grown. Meanwhile, on the other side of the pond, Austria is preparing to place millions of unvaccinated people on lockdown as Chancellor Alexander Schallenberg expresses the exasperation of many European leaders, calling it shameful that people refuse to get vaccinated, just putting their communities at risk. The move comes as COVID cases are surging in Europe. Oh, yeah, and by the way, over there in Europe, the leaders of Belarus have got an extremist grift going. Yep, they're massing refugees from the Middle East on the border of Poland with promises they'll be giving entry into Poland. The problem? Number one, it was all a scam, it's all a lie, wasn't going to happen. Two, Poland's right-wing government doesn't want them. Prepared for more of this stuff as a way of stoking up the right-wing extremism as the climate crisis grows. And Republicans are getting high on their own supply with ivermectin. Yep, Joe Rogan has become the right-wing's go-to source for medical advice. Cue Aaron Rodgers. Meanwhile, the pandemic news takes a turn for the worse. That's always good news, right? As we're seeing a surprising spike in COVID cases in states with high vaccination levels. Yep, like, for example, Vermont, with the highest vaccination rates. That paints a rather concerning picture for the winter. And today, a little closer to home, daytime TV host and vaccine skeptic Dr. Oz is looking to make a gubernatorial run in Pennsylvania. Yeah, there you go. Throw it all in. Gotta love it. Connor Lamb went on social media the other night telling everyone that he's just a normal brunch-going mansion-like Democrat. Yeah, look, I can even do the accent. And if you don't like it, well, you know, that he's not your guy. Connor, not my guy. Oh, God. You could almost smell the desperation in the air on that guy. In the days following Lamb's late-night Twitter rant about socialism, Civics and the Inquirer released a new poll showing that Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman is polling at 52%, while Lamb was polling at 12%. Clearly not our guy. Hundreds of striking Scranton Federation of Teachers members went to the Capitol Wednesday, calling out the, quote, state-sponsored union busting, unquote, happening in Scranton. The teachers went on strike over a week ago after working without a contract for 4 years. Speakers included Senator Marty Flynn, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, and House Representative Malcolm Kenyatta. And Sean got some freaking awesome pictures of that event there in Harrisburg, too, as well. And Central Bucks School Board meeting goes off the rails as a few members of the community take to the mic during the public comment period to spew transphobic and anti-Semitic comments. And the guy who did the transphobic stuff, turns out he's a regular at the Penridge School Board meetings too as well. People refer to him colloquially and lovingly as MAGA Santa. So MAGA Santa making his rounds. There you go. And Mother Jones at WHYY looked at the quote-unquote successes of fringe school board PACs had with their school board races, and it turns out the PAC supporting right-wing candidates had zero victories in competitive races across Bucks and Montgomery counties. Now, what that means actually going forward is kind of a really kind of interesting, questionable mix, right? So we got to keep an eye on that. But this is, you know, there's a sliver of good news in the midst of that. Not in my backyard, certainly, but certainly overall, that's the case. My backyard, we got QAnon people on the freaking school board now. So that's a success, I guess. Kutztown University food service workers continue the fight for a union. Yep, they will be holding a rally at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday, November 16th outside South Dining Hall on campus. There's going to be a press conference at 4:30 that you should also be tuning into to as well. Make sure you follow them on Instagram. Just click the link in today's show notes to find out what Kutztown University's food service workers are doing. Kutztown University food service workers are the only ones in the state system of higher education without a union. And in today's last call, yes, SpaceX launched another four astronauts to the International Space Station this week on its Crew 3 mission. The launch marks SpaceX's fifth crewed launch in less than 18 months. And the Senju 13 astronauts continued construction of China's new space station over the weekend in a 6.5-hour spacewalk. This is the first of two or three planned spacewalks to install a robotic arm and prepare the module for the arrival of new equipment and modules over next year. And always kind of encouraging news coming out of the space industry sector. Heinz rolled out its first Mars Edition ketchup this week. Yep, ketchup was made from tomatoes grown in Mars-like conditions. According to CNN, quote, a team of 14 astrobiologists worked for 9 months at the Aldrin Space Institute, the Florida Institute of Technology, growing tomatoes in a controlled environment with soil, temperature, and water conditions similar to Mars. Research team leader Andrew Palmer said, quote, before now, most efforts around discovering ways to grow in Martian simulated conditions are short-term plant growth studies. What this project has done is look at some long-term food harvesting. Achieving a crop that is the quality to become Heinz tomato ketchup was the dream result, and we achieved it. There you have it. There you have it. We'll have more for you on Last Call today, too, as well. And if you're looking for more PA Progressive Talk, tune into the Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern on his YouTube channel, Twitter, or Facebook, wherever you get your streams. And subscribe to his podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure you head on over to ricksmithshow.com for all the latest across all those platforms. I frankly can't keep up with him. You know, he's on WBAI in New York, on KPFK in Los Angeles, right? He's got a show on Free Speech TV on the weekends. Freaking awesome stuff going on the Rick Smith Show. And if you haven't already, you also got to check out the Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. You can find it on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast. The amazing PA women stirring the political cauldron behind this podcast rock the house. And they know where the bodies are buried. Yep, make sure you follow them also on Twitter at the Night Caucus. That's at the Night Caucus on Twitter. And for all you gamers out there, you got to check out the Game In. That's with two N's, the Game In. That's a Quakertown-based black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show, and they've got everything from retro N64s to the latest consoles. Video games for all platforms, collectibles, action figures, Funko Pops, boom. And look, it's back to school time, so every A that your kid gets them a discount at The Game Inn. Check them out at their Facebook page. Follow them at Twitter at The Game Inn. If you've got a question about a game, looking for something special, shoot them an email at thegameinpa@gmail.com. And a special shout out goes, as always, to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page. Follow him on Twitter at @SongOfDayMan with two N's. That's @SongOfDayMan on Twitter. And some programming notes. We've got some awesome shows coming up on Out to Coop Live. On Monday, November 15th, that's this Monday coming up at 7 p.m., we'll have Laura Putnam on. She's a professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, and she'll be on the show to talk about the growing left progressive political movements in the Pittsburgh area. And we'll also look at those as against the backdrop of her article, Rust Belt in Transition, about what happened in Pennsylvania and the Rust Belt's middle suburbs counties and if it can be reversed. And we'll do a little election reflection there too as well to see what's going on. And then on Monday the 22nd, that's November 22nd at 7 p.m., we're going to change the things up a little bit. I've got a kind of really cool thing. It'll be cool for me. I hope it's going to be cool for a group of folks out there. I'll be welcoming Gwen Marshall to the show. Gwen is an associate professor of philosophy at Florida International University. And we're going to be talking about her book, Ancestry and Culture, An Alternative to Race in 5e. What is 5e, you ask? It's the fifth edition of Dungeons & Dragons. Yes, indeed. Now, why we're having on this show, this book looks to bring to the world of tabletop role-playing games a more critical and dynamic understanding of race and culture. And given what happened in the video game industries and video game cultures around race and how the alt-right made use of this, to see folks in the tabletop role-playing game communities actually make proactive interventions in questions of race is really freaking cool. And this is an award-winning book that came out, Ancestry and Culture, An Alternative to Race in 5e. Hope you'll join us for that show too as well. We've got another awesome guest coming up that's going to come on. We're going to talk a little bit about climate change in Pennsylvania. I'll let you know who that is as soon as we got a date nailed down. I'm really excited about that one too as well. And look, everybody, we got great stuff going on here, but if we want the progressive future, we need progressive media. Support Pull No Punches homegrown progressive media today. Become a patron of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress today. Help keep the media and the movement, and the movement and the media. Become a patron for as little as $5 a month. You're going to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're not ready to become a patron, you want to drop us a one-time donation, you can at paypal.me/rcpress. Sean, man, how you doing? It's great to see you, man.
Doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I was wondering if I was going to be able to hear you. that was a thing.
Yeah, I was same here once I like unmuted my microphone. So thankfully I was able to, we'll see how long this rides out.
Yeah, it's pretty good. So sorry, we got a little bit of a late start. Sean was having a little tech issues then, and then I had a little glitch on my end, but then hopefully we got things up and running. Everything's coming through right now. Want to make sure that I get this off right off the bat. Emily's in the chat asking if there's a strike fund to donate to the Kutztown dining workers. They are not on strike yet. They have a rally. They're looking for recognition, but we will certainly keep you posted on this show about where you can go to help them out. Make sure you're following them on their Instagram page, on their Facebook page, and KU Food Service Workers United, and support those workers, let them know you're looking out for them. That's great.
Oh, I want to start off by saying Dr. Oz is going to be running for Senate. And that was my mistake in the notes.
Oh, I'm sorry. And I just read it too, didn't I? I said,
yeah.
My bad. Sorry. I was just realizing. I said, as you just said that, I'm like, oh wait, I said that too. Okay. Yeah, no problem.
Yeah.
Sorry, folks. My bad. The Senate race. So, although you know. I don't know. He could run for governor too, I guess, right?
Actually, he can't because I think there is an actual residency requirement. We had to be living in state for at least 8 years or 10 years.
Oh, is it 8, 10 years? Like, oh, okay. All right. Good.
Yeah. There is a residency requirement to run for governor of Pennsylvania.
Well, look, he did live in Pennsylvania when he was in school here ages ago. And apparently what I'm told, he visits from time to time, Sean. So. But yeah, so that shows you a little bit of the desperation that's going on in the Republican Party right now. But it also presents a different kind of challenge now because they're bringing in celebrity status to kind of go up against whoever gets the nomination on the
Democratic side. Like, I've actually been thinking about this. When does Joe Rogan run for fucking president?
Oh, God.
I mean, I have a feeling that might happen one day. Just be like,
you just gave me like whatever, like that was like a buzzkill.
You remember glimmer of hope you had?
I hadn't been thinking about that at all, right? And now you said that. Now that's it generally got me concerned.
No, I mean, so, like, but like that is where the Republican Party has gone, is like cult of personality.
That's true.
Like people like, you know, Donald Trump, Joe Rogan. I mean, Rogan is more trusted than Fauci on the right wing now. Like,
well, and I'll tell you that's absolutely true. And I would say that this is where, you know, I mean, Joe Rogan's influence is heavy. I mean, the fact that, you know, after, you know, became clear that Aaron Rodgers had just been lying about, you know, whether or not he had been vaccinated or not, for him to finally come out and basically say, well, my good friend Joe Rogan said, I'm like, holy shit. Are you serious? I can't believe this came back to Joe Rogan.
Tim Pool said the same thing a few weeks ago, too. When Tim Pool got sick.
Tim Pool, I can understand, right? Tim Pool, fine. But to have it come out of the mouth of, like, Aaron Rodgers, like, in this thing, like, you know, again, so you've got, number one, you got a whole bunch of people out there going, yeah, right? And then you've got a whole bunch of other people that are sitting there, like, say, like, Joe Rogan? Who's Joe Rogan? And now they're checking out Joe Rogan, right? So that's like, oh, Jesus Christ.
You just Rogan-pilled.
Yeah, there you go.
No, but I mean, it's crazy how, like, so was, did Rodgers take ivermectin? And it just shows you, like, this whole entire, like homeopathic, homeopathic or, like, natural herbalistic medicine bullshit that these people will go on. Instead of just getting the fucking shot, like, it's amazing. Like, instead of just getting the shot, vaccinated, like they're people are like literally just like wrapped up into this like herbal remedies stuff.
Well, this is the really interesting
part. And like snake oil, but
no, but I you mean, know, it's true. But you also look at, you know, this is the really interesting kind of intersection, interesting kind of like in a purely academic sense. It's not interesting when you're talking about, you know, people who are freaking destroying our world, but interesting in the sense that this is what the inroads that the QAnon movement made into this kind of new agey crew, right? I think is kind of like, I mean, again, what you're talking about, that was there before, but I think that kind of just like launched it even further, right? Into this all this experimental crystal vibration nonsense that kind of was like going to prevent COVID from happening. And then of course you got validators like, you know, Joe Rogan, you know, basically coming out and saying like, take the paste, you know, I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. And then, and it's, I was going to say something else about this, but I mean, it seems like even with like prior pandemics, there's always been like vaccine hesitancy. Once it come out, like I think with influenza, like in 19 in the teens, like people were talking about, but it's just like, it's always been an undercurrent, but it's just amazing how it just gets exploited every time.
No, and I think that there's, you know, there's something that's really different.
The,
you know,
and it's always like the same factors that are exploiting it, like trash media. Like it's, yeah.
But what has happened, the one thing I think is a little bit different, right, that we've got right now is because the inroads of like 40 years of neoliberal ideology and kind of extreme individualism and all this kind of stuff around, you know, and the inroads of the alt-right and libertarianism and all that stuff into our popular discourse, right? It's gotten to the point where, you know, people are like, are hesitant. I mean, it's again, especially the, you know, the Democratic Party leadership and, you know, the folks that are of that kind of 90s bent. They're all kind of gun shy about just to say, you know, we're going to freaking mandate this shit. You know, it's like, we're going to, you know, you don't have a vaccination. Well, you know, we're just going to do what Austria does. You know, it's like, we'll lock you down, go home. Right. And the fact that we see Biden actually coming out and basically pushing for this stuff is, you know, is really interesting. I mean, because you look what happened at like Tom Wolf in Pennsylvania. It's like, well, kind of like we would love it if everybody would have this stuff, but we're going to leave wide open kind of like exceptions to the rule. So really it's up to you.
And then you saw NYPD, like only 30 out of like 20,000 officers didn't get the vaccine, which is like pretty good compliance.
Right. And you've also seen a disproportionate like number of deaths, right? As a result of this, like in of police officers and hospitalizations and all this other stuff, because, you know, I mean, you're coming in contact with people every day. So, you know, you've got this huge pushback coming from, you know, the police unions. You know, we should think of another name for unions, you know.
And they weren't really wearing masks the whole time either.
No, exactly. So it's like, that's for me, there's always this dual side of it, right? I mean, on the one hand, it's like you've got these like freaking absolute kind of nut jobs and you just want to just go after them. On the other hand, there's a real tragedy there. I mean, people are freaking actually dying that didn't need to die, right? And that, and that's the craziness about it. And, you know, I'm really wondering what's going to happen now where, you know, like I was saying, is that we're seeing these uptick of cases that is happening in even in highly vaccinated states. That it doesn't bode well moving forward. And there's real big question marks about why this is. And, you know, I mean, there's, on the one hand, people are like, look, it's getting colder. People are moving indoors. They're in more in close proximity again. There's also a certain degree of, there's still a large pool of folks that are unvaccinated, right? And, you know, there's a point where most places have begun to kind of like relax masking mandates masking, and people are kind of tired. And so you've got all this stuff going on as we go into the winter, and, you know, you fingers crossed that we can actually, you know, keep the hospitalizations down. But if we see a similar trend that's going on right now in the highly vaccinated states now start to move into places like Pennsylvania, for example, to have a lower rate of vaccination than like Vermont or New Hampshire or some of these other places that have these outbursts, we're going to be in trouble. And there's going to be people who are unvaccinated who are going to be significantly impacted by this.
Yeah. No, it's not going away.
Yep. Sean's, you know what Sean's thinking about right now? Sean's thinking about kind of being out at the bar without his mask, having his wings, and talking to people. That's what he's thinking about right now.
Exactly. Yep.
I can read it on your face.
I mean, I will say I've been going to the bar recently. I'm not going to lie about that.
No, I know. But, you know, but again, I think that's, you know, we want to be in that place, right?
I mean, I think we've seen it, though, too. I mean, I feel like I've seen the fatigue up close, like just from being like going to the Capitol and doing stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like you can tell, you can sense it's out there. And I mean, like, you know, like we're still feeling the reverberations of, like, you know, a supply chain shortage. We have people who, I'm not saying they're refusing to work, but people who have, you know, come to the sense of what their value of work means. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean?
Yep.
You know, people had a year and a half to do this. I mean, the pandemic itself might be ending soon, but I really feel like the economic reverberations are going to be something that we're going to have to be dealing with for like generations now.
Yeah, I
like
agree.
It's the long-term health impacts and all, but
no, absolutely. No. But this is exactly where, I mean, this
I
is
mean,
why...
but we're just going to have like a bunch of climate deniers saying it never happened.
Well, I'm very well. We'll talk about climate in a second because that's going to be a. But let's.
Or science deniers,
right? And I think that it's this is going to be I'm going to hold off on that for a second because that's like I don't want to go down a hole on this for a moment. I will in a little bit because I do want to talk about the climate and the impact. But first, the one thing that, you know, this is where, you know, all attention has got to be paid on what is on the Build Back Better bill at this point. I mean, as pared down as the bill is right now, the $1.75 trillion Build Back Better bill, that is, let's be clear, that right now, that is, I would say that is our only hope, right now, to actually get some significant concrete plans in on climate crisis mitigation and planning. Because if this doesn't go through, then all bets are off. There's no way a piece of climate legislation is going to get through, I would say. And already, you know, see, again, who were the people that voted against the infrastructure bill, the fossil fuel infrastructure bill that passed last week, right? Well, it was the squad, right? And why did the squad do that? The squad voted against it because it said, no, the agreement was... First of all, the agreement was $3.5 trillion, and that's what everybody had signed off on initially. And that's been whittled almost in half, just in half, right? So that was number one. Number two, they recognize the only power, the only leverage that, say, like people have who want the Build Back Better bill is to hold up on the infrastructure bill. That was it. But the Progressive Caucus signed off and say, okay, we're going to take a handshake. Biden had said that, you know, it's not going to be a problem. He sends out his economic advisor, say, yeah, no problem. We think we're going to get this passed, no problem, right? And then as soon as that infrastructure bill passed, like within the next day, Republicans are out there screaming about inflation, right? Oh my God, things are going off the rails because of all this government spending. We can't do anymore. Moderate Democrats are bolting back to their corporate sugar daddies. And then here we are. Now we have the kind of, you know, the Congressional Budget Office coming out and slow rolling. It's kind of like, you know, it's readings of the budget impact of this stuff, which is not, I should say, it's not unprecedented. It's not something that they're doing kind of like, you know.
No, it's just like the Democrats waiting for the parliamentarian to tell them what they should do or should not do.
Exactly.
And it's just like, I mean, you know, the Democrats, if they're going to lose in 2022, they're going to lose because of stuff like this. And, you know, because of, like, there, I mean, like what Connor Lamb said, Abigail Spanberger said, you know, like, we just want to go back to normal. Like,
it doesn't go back. There is no going back.
There is no going back to normal. Like, there is no, like, and it's just like, you know, like, they're just going to be like, these people are going to get fucking crushed, like, saying, I'm your normal Democrat. Like, what's the normal Democrat? The one that's holding up Build Back Better,
right?
Like, you know what I mean?
Exactly. And like, you look at it like this,
like someone who voted with Trump 70% of the time, like, in Connor Lamb voted for the Trump tax cuts.
Absolutely. Like, we'll say, like, we'll, like, here's just another example why things aren't going back, are going back to some sort of freaking mythical normal, right? Because number one, just during COVID, right, we recognize all the wealth went to the top, right? There was a huge profit taking kind of in the top 1%. Like, massive shifts of wealth away from working people and away from the middle class to the top 1%, right? I mean, like, hundreds of percentage increases in their profits, making the richest people on the planet. And that was a policy that came out of that. Yes, it was under Trump, but that has not changed. And it will not change unless Build Back Better is actually enacted, right? That's number one. Number two, the way that our workforce is structured now has been fundamentally altered. And it is not going back to normal. And where this is going to shake out yet, we don't know. And number three, we have a climate catastrophe on our doorstep. Going, pretending there is a normal that we could return to in the back is freaking sticking your head in the sand like a freaking ostrich.
Now, you know what else it is?
Tell me.
It's enjoying your Sundays at brunch.
Yes, it is. It is.
I mean, like, that's exactly... Hey, it feels good sitting outside, you know, 60 degree weather in the middle of November, you know, where you can sit down and have your Bloody Marys and stuff like that.
But look, I have to say,
look, no, but I mean, like, this is what they're like pontificating, or this is what they're going towards. Like, this, like we want to go back to normal. Like, you're not going right, back to normal.
The thing
after
is, what's crazy about it, Sean, is that the any guarantee. To have, you know, that kind of picture of, like, hanging outside with your friends in some kind of leisure, kind of sipping on drinks, enjoying your day without a care, is dependent upon things like the Build Back Better reconciliation bill. Because if we don't address this stuff, good luck. Like, I mean, like, I'm serious. Is that what is happening right now? We saw all the kind of right-wing extremism going on. That's not going away, right? What do you think is going to happen when Kyle Rittenhouse gets off? What do you think is going to happen? We're going to go back to normal? Back to normal means a right-wing extremist who shot and killed two people in the streets of Wisconsin, shot and injured somebody else, could go on and put on a freaking clown performance and crying about, he was going to point a gun at me. Yeah, in cross-examination, what do we see? Cross-examination, it's pretty clear. The prosecutor says, well, let me get this straight. My understanding is, and the film show, that you were pointing the gun at somebody else before they pointed the gun at you. Shouldn't they have been a concern for their lives? Oh, blah, 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 blah. But can I go back to my crying fit? That seemed to work. Right? You watch. You got a judge who's playing freaking, like, kind of right-wing kind of theme songs on his phone. What do you think is going to happen? Is that the back to normal you want to go to? Watching black people gunned down in the streets and actually the white people who kill them go free because they were afraid their foo-foos were hurt and they were just scared? Seriously? Why does he have an AR-15? Because he thought it was cool, and we're going to say that's okay? That's the normal you want to go back to?
The rise of, like, militias?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, in your county, in Bucks County, or my county out here in Dauphin?
It's not going back. I mean, look, we got a freaking QAnon people on our school boards now here in Bucks County. Not all of the districts, certainly, but certainly in mine, certainly over in Palisades. And guess what? That's not normal. And it's not changing anytime soon. And what do you think is going to happen when states like ours are going to have to kind of try to deal with, I mean, we've already seen the deluges of rain and devastation being brought upon by climate-affected weather. Right? We don't address it. It's going to get worse. Your normal's gone. Does that mean that you can't go outside and kind of like sit with your friends and have a drink, right, and do brunch? No, of course it doesn't mean that. But what it means is sticking your head in the sand and only doing brunch is not social action and is not going to do anything to help the world at this point, let alone your neighbors. I'll stop with that. So I don't know, Sean. I mean,
covered all the bases on that one.
Yeah, that was I was weaving a tapestry.
Climate,
on that,
right? Rittenhouse.
Yeah. I wove it. It's a nice little quilt, right?
Yeah. Gozar. Right. At this point.
Well, let me just say this is why I wanted to put the stuff in about what's going on in Belarus and Poland too as well, and it has everything to do with climate, right? Because what we're signing, I mean, really, it's a disgrace what's happening at COP26 right now. I mean, you know, Greta Thunberg is 100% right. It's about a whole bunch of blah, blah, blahs coming out of that. And yes, like Biden is like standing up there and talking about how great it is that the United States and China agreed to this side deal and all this stuff. That is good. Look, it is a positive thing. There's no doubt about it.
Is where I wish like Michael Brooks was still around to do like Biden impersonations and shit like that.
Oh my God, I miss it. I miss it so much. I miss it. I really do.
Well, little girl,
I'm telling you, I was just
like that, like, well, little girl, like patting on her head, like you're doomed.
Yeah, no, exactly. I was funny. You should say that.
I got a few years left here.
Yeah. I was thinking about him this week. That's funny. You should say that.
Yeah.
So here's the thing, right? I mean, I talked a little bit about this on the show last week, on Out the Coop Live when I did the climate focused, night. But what you're seeing right now is that you're seeing there's trajectories. You know, and I think that Kate Aronoff, I just finished her book, Overheated, and it's just actually fantastic. And she's been one of the people who's been writing about this, and she makes the case really clearly in her book. She said, like, look, moving forward, it's clear that right now the right wing and the Republicans are even beginning to move off their climate denial as their way that they're going to approach it. Doesn't mean that it's not still there. Of course it still is. But what they're moving towards is like to saying, well, how are you actually going to be kind of responding to this stuff? Right. And she makes the case, and I'm going to butcher the way that she says it. I don't have the book in front of me right now, but she says something like this. It's not going to be about whether climate change exists or not moving forward. Climate is going to be the terrain upon which these political struggles are fought. Right. So what do I mean by that? Let's just, you look at what's happening in Belarus right now. In Belarus, you've got the kind of, you know, dictator Yushchenko, I think his name is, basically, and the kind of government support is up. Well, actually, you got these refugees that were fleeing from the Middle East, right? Iraq and some other kind of countries. And they told them, said, hey, look, we've got this deal worked out with Poland where you could kind of come in, fly into Kiev, right? Then we'll take you to Poland and you kind of go over to Poland, right? It's great. You know, you come over here, you give me some money and I'll help you do that, right? It's a big grift. And so they bring them in, right? They transport them off the border to Poland, right? The border guards of Poland are like, what are you talking about? Right? Why are you bringing all these people to the border? Right? And in Poland, of course, Poland is dominated by a right-wing government right now. Anti-immigrant government, stuff like this. So now you see these, you know, brown people massing at the border of Poland. And what is that doing? That is whipping up the anti-immigrant folks, right-wing, anti-immigrant, pro-violent, anti-like folks to the border, who are then to say absolutely want to keep these people out, right? And that's also happening now. Similar things are now happening up in, like, in Latvia and some of the other Baltic states up there. And so what's going on? And then Belarus keeps on pushing them more. So now you've got these people, brown folks, right? In many cases, Muslim, in these like random kind of makeshift tent cities out right on the border where Poland won't let them in. And when they try to cross, they force them back into Belarus. And Belarus is like, no, we don't want you here either. This is a setup for absolute violence. And in the big picture, right, why is that happening? I view this as a strategy. This is a way of kind of like showing that this is the response we got to have. When you have migrants and refugees, you're going to keep them out and you're going to militarize your borders.
I think we're seeing that also with like the surges of migrants coming from Latin America.
Exactly.
With some of the, not like just in the United States, but also some of the countries they're passing through along the way with their caravans.
Yep.
No, like those police departments or armies or local, whatever they are pretty militarized and have no problem attacking caravan goers leaving Honduras or other like Latin American countries that we've affected over the past 20 years.
Absolutely. And so this is what Kate Aronoff is talking about. So basically, so a lot of these folks, right? I don't know if we could say most of them, but a lot of these folks are not climate refugees, right? You could make a case for it. Let me put it that way. And there is a reason why you can make a case for it. But let me just say, if they're not kind of like, that is not the primary reason they seem to be kind of like escaping, at least in popular consciousness. But that's going to be increasingly the case. So what Kate Aronoff is arguing, and I believe this is happening right now, is that there's going to be a battle over how we deal with the climate crisis. Are we going to the road of authoritarianism, right? And borders and militarized borders, which also means militarized borders within our country, because climate refugees are not going to be just people from outside. They're going to be people within our own borders who are going to be disproportionately black and brown, disproportionately poor and working class. And they're going to have to move someplace, right? What happens in that scenario?
And you know what, looking at like the maps and everything, like there's only going to be a handful of habitable areas in the country left within 100 years. And you know, central Pennsylvania is one of them, like yep. The area around the Great Lakes. It's pretty much it.
Yep.
I mean, where places like north, like going into like Buffalo or Canada, or not Buffalo, but like the plains of Canada and stuff like that.
Yep. And so if we can't do something, and this is like exactly it, is like the Build Back Better bill. This is why the Build Back Better bill is also, it's a referendum really on what we're going to do with climate in this country. Because if this, like I said, if this doesn't go through, I see very little hope of anything getting done in the past 4 years. And the target set in Paris and what was supposedly reaffirmed with their kind of like, you know, magic unicorn thinking at COP26 was to have a bunch of targets met by 2030. Well, TikTok, it's almost 2022 now. We're running out of time. And so if this doesn't go through, then you've got what? 2022, 2023, 2024. That's 3 years. Now we're at, let's do the math, everybody, right? Now we're at 2024 going into 2025, right? Then we'll have 5 years with nothing done, which means that you'll have to have more extreme action in order to hit those targets, which means you're going to be more resistance to that. So what's it going to be? You know, that's where we're at. That's where we're at. So this is why I think the story, watching what happens in Belarus, watching what happens in these countries here, I think we need to see it in that context, right? It's not just a kind of a conflict that is happening out there. It has everything to do with the pathways forward that we're going to be fighting on, right? So, I mean, to, you know, watch that situation. Anyways, oh, God, it drives me absolutely crazy. And it makes me really freaking nervous, too, as well, I have to say. Yeah, just wanted to couple just kind of quick things there, too, as well. We already touched on the Joe Rogan stuff, too, which is great. But Also, keep an eye on what's happening with the COVID pandemic. We'll be tracking that kind of going forward. There is something I was going to put this. Emily wrote this in the chat too as well, and I was going to actually mention this, but I didn't put it in the show notes. There was a study that just they did in Iowa, and they were finding out that white-tailed deer have become reservoirs of COVID-19, right? In particular, the Delta variant. The deer are not getting sick, right? So they are not expressing it, but they're carrying the virus, right? Which is then spreading to human communities too as well. That report just came out, like, I think yesterday or 2 days ago. So that's other concerning. There was other some reports that came out of Europe where there were some pets, some dogs in particular, that also tested positive for that. And they're also concerned that they're going to be some carriers there. So we're going to watch that moving forward. Anyways, Sean, anything else going on in the national scope you want to take a look at?
Nothing too much.
All right, cool. All right, so this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Sean, I'm going to remind you, this is one of the tech issues we're having before. Sean, I'm going to remind you, you're not going to hear the music, but I'll let you know. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Want to remind you that you can go to patreon.com/rcpress to help support this show and all of our podcasts by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. And if you're on our YouTube channel right now, making sure you hit that subscribe button, make sure you like this stream that you're listening to right now or watching right now, and make sure you hit that notification bell so you know every time we go live, and share it out to as many people as you possibly can. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We're going to be right back after this quick break.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. That was the day Ellis Island closed its doors. More than 12 million immigrants had passed through its gates since it opened in 1892. Those steerage and third-class passengers coming to America were processed at the island between 1892 and 1924. They were routinely subject to medical inspections to determine they were free of disease. Legal inspections included questions regarding birth, occupation, destination, finances, and criminal record. The busiest year was 1907, with more than 1 million arriving to enter the United States. During World War I, the island was used as a detention center for presumed enemies and those considered foreign-born subversives. After Congress passed the Restrictive Immigration Act of 1924, arrivals entering the country slowed to a trickle. Then Ellis Island became primarily a detention and deportation center. During World War II, thousands of Germans, Italians, and Japanese made up the majority of those detained awaiting deportation. It also served as a military hospital for returning servicemen and training center for the Coast Guard. By 1950, Ellis Island served as a holding center for arriving communists and fascists who were prevented entrance under the recently passed Internal Security Act. A Norwegian seaman who had overstayed his leave was released the day the island closed and told to catch the next ship back to Norway. In 1965, President Johnson made Ellis Island part of the National Park Service. A massive restoration of the island began in 1984, organized by Lee Iacocca's Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation. It reopened as the Ellis Island Immigration Museum in 1990, featuring numerous exhibits, publicly accessible immigration records, and the award-winning film documentary Island of Hope, Island of Tears. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Hey, everybody. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken, here once again with that guy who's back at brunch, Sean Kitchen, enjoying his Sunday mornings in a very leisurely way. Right. I have to say is that this might be kind of like the official week of the launch into 2022. It feels like that to me more so than we saw some of the initial announcements, especially since we get the, we find out that we're getting national TV personality is going to be throwing their hat in the ring on the GOP side here, Sean.
Yeah. Daytime TV, Dr. Oz is looking to be running for Senate. It's only rumored at this point. I don't know if it's been confirmed. Free Beacon reported it, and I normally don't take what that or what they say for what they say as truth. But I mean, this is just like so far out left field where I can absolutely see them doing this. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like this can actually be right. They got the scoop on this.
Yep.
So definitely looking forward to that. I mean, this like Republican primary race is going to be fucking crazy. One, you have Sean Parnell, who's a woman beater at the top of the ticket, who is getting most of the support. He's been trying to stop that stuff from coming out of court. That came out of court. You now have like people threatening to self-fund their campaigns because of Parnell's accusations against him. So it seems like it's going to be pretty crazy, which is just like it's par for the course. Another like campaign where we have like 8 or 9 people running for one office. And I mean, you think about it, like with their governor, Republican governors and the Senate, you know, 8 or 9 people in a field, you can win with like 30% of the vote and become a nominee.
Well, you know what I hear? You know what I hear, Sean, when you tell me that? Cha-ching. Right? I mean, this is the Republican grift model, right? I mean, you got.
Oh, I mean, like, you think about it.
I'm going to make money.
But also, you think about, like, what happened in New Jersey and what happened in Virginia. National Democrats are looking at this race and just pumped up the money tree a bit. Like, you know what I mean? Just, yep. Like, more money came off the money tree because these two races just got that much more important here in PA. I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah, and we should say that, you know, this was reported also in Penn Live about Dr. Oz, and they said, okay, look, there's rumors about this. People magazine quoted a spokesperson from Dr. Oz's show, and he said at this time he's got no announcement, but there certainly does seem to be some push kind of in this direction, right? Somebody who was from the Oz show, a spokesperson, said that Dr. Oz has received encouragement to run for U.S. Senate, but is currently focused on our show. Right. So basically what,
like,
that
who
means,
the fuck is encouraging him?
Right. That's the big question. Right. And so, you know, and that means one of two things. Right. That means either.
Trump?
Yeah. I mean, we got to see. It means one of two things. It means, number one, it means that there are people in the moneyed interest in the Republican Party that are approaching him and think he'd be a good candidate. Or number two, that means that Dr. Oz is actually kind of thinking about running, and he's just basically telling everybody that people are telling him that they want him to run.
Yeah, right? Which I think is the latter part.
Yeah, that'd be my guess.
I think if you're a moneyed person in Republican politics,
yeah,
you're not going to be funding Dr. Oz's campaign. That'd probably be the last thing you'd be funding. No, but like, you know, like both these races are wide open for a self-funder to jump in and like fund their own campaign.
Yep.
What's happening. So yeah. So there's that. On the Democratic side, Connor Land the other night, after the infrastructure bill was passed, went on Twitter to tell everyone that he is not a socialist. Don't consider himself a socialist.
Like, what?
And
what's going on?
I mean, like, went into like this red baiting attack. I think this was probably his brother Coleman who tweeted this out, and you know, pretty much like saying, you know, I'm going to be a normal Democrat, and you know, if you know, and I'm not your guy if you're a socialist, pretty much.
It was the weirdest. I got to say, it was just freaking weird too.
Yeah, no, it's so one, it makes sense. That tweet came out with the poll that followed up the next day, the civics poll with, you know, Fetterman at 52% and Lamb at 12.
Yeah,
I'm sure he had no the results of that coming in or like, but also you're having rumors now that like people are approaching Lamb to pivot and run against Summer Lee out in Pittsburgh if he, like, they're part of that district.
Yep, they're like, okay, look, Connor, you don't got a shot in hell to make this one, right? So why don't you head over and go after? And that seems to me like what that tweet was about.
Yeah, and like you saw Summers responding the next day, basically saying like, this tweet is about like who was it decide to have power and who's allowed to have power in politics.
Exactly.
And here, like, you know, Connor Lamb comes from a political family. And if his last name didn't start with L and end in Am, you know, he wouldn't be in politics. No, but I mean, it's serious.
Yep.
Like, if this person wasn't a fail son of a powerful political politician, like, or a political family, like, he would not be in office.
Absolutely. Right. And let's be clear too, as well, as like, you know, one of the things that, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. And because look,
and it's also the type of thing, like with Lamb, like this, I've always said this, like, you're never going to see a Democrat from Western Pennsylvania run as a conservative moderate Democrat and win a statewide primary anymore. Like, those days are gone.
Yep.
Those days left 20 years ago. You know, maybe like Wolf might be the last more moderate Democrat you elect to this type of office.
Yep.
Well, Shapiro is next year going to get a nomination. But like, the thing is, it's like, you're not going to have that pro-life conservative Democrat running for statewide office and running in this state anyway, just because of where the power of the party's shifting in the demographics.
Well, what's interesting, and this is like a little preview of like when I talk with Laura Putnam on Monday, when she'll be on the show. This is one of the things that in this article, she got like Rust Belt in transition, you know, so the character like Connor Lamb, right? Not only is it true that like you see this kind of like progressive infrastructure, right? Left progressive infrastructure building up around in Western Pennsylvania, and particularly around the Pittsburgh and the suburbs around Pittsburgh, right? These former kind of industrial cities, is that the politics of people like Connor Lamb, right? And, you know, in her article and things like, she kind of rolls this through, were a part and parcel of the reason why you saw this gradual inability of the Democrats to really kind of gain any kind of momentum out west, and the kind of the surge of these kind of Trumpist Republicans, is because they stopped paying attention to the, you know, the fundamental issues of working people in the area. And now that's what you see people like Summer Lee, Sarah Enmerato, you know, we could go down the list of folks that have kind of won these races, have really built some strength and some organizational infrastructure out there. And Connor Lamb is just trying to get people to kind of like, you know, pretend that we can go back to some mythical time that never was.
Yeah. So
there you have it.
And then Wednesday, the Capitol was pretty
big
nice. Yes. The Scranton Federation of Teachers, they went on strike a couple weeks ago over wages, healthcare, and working without a contract for 4 years. They called the recovery plan in process basically state-sponsored union busting, and that like plans consolidation and can't be changed, calling on Governor Wolf and legislative leaders to take action on this. But what was really awesome, were the speakers there, Senator Marty Flynn, Lieutenant Governor Fetterman, and House Rep Malcolm Kenyatta spoke there. You had speakers from, Kyle Mullins, who's from the area, speak there, and all the Democrats from that area came out, which is really nice.
So Sean, I'm just,
and I got some awesome photos.
I mean, I don't want to, yes, you got awesome photos. I don't want to take us back, like, you know, too far back in time, but it seems strange to me that Connor Lamb wasn't there supporting those striking teachers too as well. I mean,
I think he was working on the Build Back Better plan in DC and getting that passed.
Oh, is that what's going on?
Yeah.
It seems like somebody who's like cares so much about, you know, his reputation and his like power in the state, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyways, let me go more seriously. We'll go back to the pictures that you got.
Right? Oh, I mean, like, well, so one of the awesome things there, I got a photo of this, was taking a picture of this older teacher, and she's like, you know, though, she's like, the teacher next to me, I had her as a student in first grade. So like, I ended up getting the photo of them two together with Marty.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome just like hearing that story. That's the type of stuff that like you love to hear when you go to a picket line. Either like, you know, parent, like you have like a family child relationship of both kids on the picket line, which happened a couple years ago, or you have like that teacher student like 20 or 30 years down the road, like on the picket line together.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was getting the class war juices going.
Yeah. Well,
and I showed up. I showed up in my Don't Mess With Scabby shirt. Awesome fucking hit to all the people. No, a couple of my friends laughed, and I said, you got to play to your base. You got to know who your audience is.
There you go.
And I didn't have to say anything to the people. They're like, oh, he has a Scabby shirt on.
Yep. No, exactly.
And they knew exactly what it meant when it says, Don't Mess With Scabby.
Yep. Well, and I'll tell you, and they're up there, and they've got out there all their signs up there, red for Ed, right? They're kind of clearly calling up these kind of, more militant approach to teacher unionization, which was great to see, right? To see this kind of really strong showing kind of up in Scranton, because Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, the whole kind of Northeast PA, the NEPA area has been. It's kind of been
you have a long union history.
That's
there.
The thing. Exactly.
And one of the things I love about, the NEPA accent.
Yeah.
And just you could tell everyone up there was from NEPA. These weren't outsiders who, were moved into the area. These are lifelong residents who became teachers in there. A couple of teachers there have been 30 or 40 years. It's a community.
So what do you think? Are we gonna get Biden out on the picket lines? You think?
I don't know.
I mean, he's a boy from Scranton after all. So
yeah. But they were a couple of them talking about going to Joe Biden's school, or the hospital. Wow. Being born in the hospital he was born in. Yeah. Also I think was pretty cool. Fetterman hung the Scranton Federation of Teachers banner off his balcony.
Nice.
Which, the balcony has become a controversial place because Republicans put a bill in place.
It's been an extension of his Twitter account. Let's just say it like that.
Yeah. So, when I saw the thing up there, I was just like, oh.
That's awesome.
Because when he spoke, I wanted to make sure. I wanted to get the balcony in focus instead of him. Because, you know what I mean?
Yep.
So, yeah, got some great photos.
That's fantastic. I was so psyched to see that to see that you were there for that, because I know that struggle has been on. As a matter of fact, I reached out to some of those folks a while back, and I know that they were just busy and organized before this has gone on, and that's something I want to follow up to see if we can get them on at some point. We'll see how far the strike goes. So we'll go from there.
Yeah.
So, in my neck of the woods, we just saw this kind of another kind of outburst of what's happening on the kind of school boards in the Central Bucks school board meeting. There was some really, let me just say, I was going to go into this kind of in more detail, but I'm just going to click on the link in the show notes so you can see it. I feel the more I've been thinking about this, I'm like, I really don't want to repeat what these people said on air, right? I just don't. Right. If you want to find out what these folks said, I would just say that they were both kind of anti-Semitic and transphobic. Right. And kind of repeating stuff that was really like horrific in those school board meetings. I found out earlier today that the guy who said some of the worst transphobic stuff that was at that school board meeting is somebody who also frequents the Penridge school board meetings. Right. To say the same kind of nonsense. So this is a guy who's kind of doesn't matter where the hell a guy lives, right? He's just going to go off and he's going to get involved with these school boards in order to kind of spew this nonsense because he's been freaking too plugged into Newsmax and kind of OAN media and all this other kind of nonsense. So that comes out and this, it got some good coverage by ABC 7 News, right? They covered it. The Courier, the Bucks County Courier Times covered it. Chris Ullery did a great job and great report on that. But in that there was a focus in part about this freedom of speech issue, right? And so when he started kind of yelling these kind of transphobic stuff and things like this, one member of the board, Karen Smith, I want to say, that's probably not her last name, but she basically came out and said basically shut up, right? You will stop this kind of immediately. Karen Smith, no, I was right. Then other school board members got in and said, no, look, we don't shut people down, right? They got 3 minutes to say what they're going to say, right? We don't have to agree with it, but they have to say. So this kind of played itself out. So there's this kind of like, my guess is that what you're going to start seeing is you're going to start seeing some of this kind of free speech stuff now making its way kind of into these school board meetings, where people are going to say increasingly hostile and hateful stuff at these school board meetings in order to provoke this kind of free speech nonsense. And we're going to see lawsuits. You watch this. Because they're going to see this, and they're going to look at the coverage of that kind of stuff, and then they're going to start showing up in order to kind of do this stuff. So that's something to kind of watch what goes on. So, yes, the Central Bucks School Board, they saw kind of two Democrats kind of gain seats there, and two really good candidates. Again, other people that I hope at some point that we're going to get them on the show on Out to Coop Live. But this is going to continue to happen. Meanwhile, and I didn't put this in the show notes, at the Penn Ridge School Board, or the Penn Ridge GOP, hosted its kind of like it's kind of like weekly or monthly meeting. Right. And they had a giant banner. There's a picture floating around on the web about this. A giant banner that was hung up behind the stage that said, "Make school boards great again." Right. So if you have any question about where at least the Penn Ridge GOP is in terms of how where they're going to put their efforts moving forward, there you have it.
So
and Chuck just jumped in and said, "Yeah, we are watching Penn Ridge." And yes, indeed, you are, Chuck. And then I'm going to be there with you. Go ahead.
So I was at an anti-vax rally on Monday walking through.
There you go.
And I noticed someone wearing an earpiece and grabbed a photo of him. Here the guy like who was cosplaying as like private security for Mastriano, like wearing a gun and everything. Wearing a three-per shirt and earpiece. He is an elected. He just got elected to school board in E-Town.
Get out of here. Are you serious?
Yeah. And they had Make E-Town School Board Great Again cake. Yeah. But like, okay, so one of the things I want to talk about.
Yeah, this is really important regarding the school boards. Yep, exactly.
So there seemed to be like a big failure narrative to come out of Mother Jones and WHYY and other news sources after the election around a couple of these PACs who received money from Jeffrey Yass and other sources, single donor sources, pretty much like this new donor class that's breeding here in Pennsylvania. They spent the summer driving all this animosity at these school boards, especially in competitive areas, and funded these candidates pretty thoroughly with like thousands of dollars.
They were dropping like $10,000 increments into school boards.
Yeah, like literally just giving out fucking cardboard checks to people. Mm-hmm. Like, and turning it into a spectacle. The reporting came out that pretty much like there were some Democrats that were supported. There were some. Looks like the Democrats support were just to give them cover to say they were bipartisan, but they were going to win the races anyway. But the competitive races that they poured this money into, promoting these conspiracy theorists, insurrectionists, militia types and others who were running for office, all got lost, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. Like they didn't win any competitive seats. They didn't flip any competitive school boards.
Right.
So you have that like failure narrative that came out, but just trying to get your thoughts on that.
So I have a couple things about this, and this is I'm glad. I mean, Sean and I talked a little about this before the show too, and I had read these same pieces too, and I've been thinking a lot about this. I've also been following again, not to kind of constantly plug the show for Monday with Laura Putnam, but her analysis has been excellent on looking at the election results. And because like initially what came out of the elections was like, Democrats are in a tailspin and blah, blah, blah. But then when you started actually looking more closely at what's happening outside of like, say, Virginia and the initial concerns around New Jersey, there's a much more complicated picture there, and in many cases, the opposite kind. So I two things come to my mind is like, number one, that was really encouraging to see that analysis, right? So that we have a little bit of a check for ourselves, say, no, look, the organizing paid off because there was a higher turnout in this election than normal, right? Which also means that, I believe, right? And again, how do you prove a negative? It's very difficult. I believe if there had not been the organizing from like Democrats and community members against this, these extremist stuff, then those school board races would have fell. So the only reason why those were unsuccessful had everything to do with the grassroots mobilization that was happening. And this is, you know, I'm thinking specifically about what's happening in Bucks County, but this is also happened in other places.
You know, like these school board races reminded me of the going to the Wagner town hall in Jenkintown.
Yep.
Right. And I went to a few of them that summer. And like that one in particular was like very hostile. Like, you know, speaking about like going to Wagner stuff up here in central Pennsylvania, you know, central Pennsylvania gets the stereotype of being like, you know, backcountry racist at times. And I mean, it lives up to the name at times, but like also you don't really see like the reactionary racism put on display, like in the suburbs of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Like very like highly fucking racist.
Yep.
Parts of this. And I remember going into the Wagner town hall and just hearing the discussions that were had with like that guy Vico Bertogli, who was sitting in front of me, who was profiled for like spreading nonsense around here with the past election. You had like all these other like just older middle-aged white people, and you almost like felt like you were at a Klan rally.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, and it's almost like the racism of, someone also mentioned this, like it's more highbrow racism in Bucks and Montgomery County. Like they don't like to be exposed as that. Like, you know what I mean?
Well, and I can totally see it. I think that's tipping.
I feel like it's more out and out now too.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, they're more open about the racism and shit like that.
Exactly.
Or they're more open, but they don't want to be held accountable for it.
Right. And but you know, again, you've got other actors now that are fostering this stuff. So here, let me go back. So here's the second point I wanted to make about this too, as well, is that had those PACs not dumped the money in, right, I would question about how successful about some of these, say, QAnon candidates could have been. Right. Because I think that basically, you know, that would have required a different mobilization for them to actually gain leverage. And again, what's the result? I don't know. Does that mean that like in a place like Penridge or Palisades, that the Democrats would have won, right? That I don't know, right? But the extreme candidates, I don't know if they would have gotten the profile and the backing and the encouragement in order to kind of take those seats. Other Republicans may have. But you remember, the Keeping Kids in School PAC, they specifically endorsed those QAnon candidates, right? It was on their webpage, right? It's kind of like, here's our candidates. That's kind of right out there. There's no question about where that kind of money went, where that support went. So that's the second. So then the third one is this. The third one is that, and we've talked about this on this show before, is those PACs have a longer horizon than these school board elections. In my view, the school board election was this was the first initial testing ground to see how this stuff shaked out. It was people like Paul Martino looking to become the kind of influencer in kind of upcoming elections in Pennsylvania. And so when they're looking at this, they're not looking just at the school board races, but they also have their eyes on the Supreme Court race and the Commonwealth Court race. And the question is, and you might know the answer to this, I don't, and about to what degree did that turnout in those districts that are supported have an influence on the overall vote tallies when it came to the Supreme Court races, which Democrats lost?
Yeah, I'm not sure, because it seemed like those counties still trend towards Democrats and from the previous.
It's true, but it's the actual vote total, right? Because that's what's key about it, right? I mean, because you're talking about the actual numbers of votes in statewide elections. So even if you have a trend towards Democrats, what are the numbers? If the percentage gap was a 10 percentage gap between Democrats and Republicans in the county before, if that goes down 2 percentage points, right, or 3 percentage points, even though it's still trending Democrat, right, that has a potential to actually swing these very, very close elections. That's and those are questions I don't have the answer to. I don't know. Right. So we see, but I mean, what we got to understand is that what Paul Martino and these other folks are doing in these PACs is they're building an infrastructure like for 2022 and 2024. That's what's important to kind of keep our eyes on. And it's also important to remember, and I said this in some of the kind of like the Facebook groups that I'm connected to, is like, you know, one thing that we got to be clear about is the organizing that was happening, the parents groups and the community groups that got, but not the Democratic Party of Bucks County, by the way, right? But the parents groups and stuff like this, I'm not saying the Democratic Party didn't do anything, but I'm saying they weren't responsible for the mobilization of the organization. It was parents and it was kind of community members who kind of stood up and did the organizing and did that kind of grassroots stuff. That is what has made the difference. And that is our infrastructure. So as much as I know that some people were kind of felt dejected kind of coming out of that, it's like, I'm telling you, that was amazing. And that is what it's kind of, what is kind of hopeful moving forward as we kind of move into 2022 and 24. But we're going to be up against the big money. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I think that's kind of my overall scope on it, Sean.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah. Okay, sounds good. All right, so listen, last thing I want to kind of notice, though Sean's gonna have to get out of here. He's got another hard out. But I just want to say this right before he takes off, like, make sure that, you know, the Kutztown University, I wish he had waited just a second, but he did not. Hold on a second, so this doesn't look so horrible. Yeah, it's gonna have to resize my frame. Sorry, everybody. For those folks who are on YouTube, you know what I'm talking about. For everybody else, you have no idea. Right, so I'm just gonna go like this. Let's see if this is gonna. No, it's not gonna do it. Anyways, all right, I'm just gonna leave it at that. We're just gonna say, okay, well, you know, I'm just gonna look weird on the screen, for next moment. So basically, let's see if that'll work. Nope, not quite. Let's see. I'm sorry, this is really not a good thing. I was hoping he was just gonna wait just another second, but he didn't. Okay, so basically what I want to say is this, is that, you know, Kutztown University food service workers are continuing their fight for a union. They're going to be holding a rally at 5:30 on Tuesday, November 16th. That is outside the South Dining Hall on the Kutztown University campus. That is a dining hall the furthest south, obviously South Dining Hall, the university campus. It's kind of... Yeah, at the end of all where all the dorms are back there, it's one of the largest dining services on campus, and they're going to be holding a rally there. There's going to be a press conference that's going to be happening before that, I believe at 4:30. If you are in the Kutztown University area, you should be out there with those students. I'm sorry, with those workers. If you're a student at Kutztown University, head out and kind of support those the food service workers who are out there. And if you live in the Kutztown area, show up and help them out to let them know that you've got their backs and they've got your support. Any faculty member of Kutztown University, like if you're going to be there, right, and you don't live 5 hours away or something like this, try to show up in order to kind of support those folks. That's 5:30 on Tuesday, November 16th, outside the South Dining Hall on campus. As a reminder, they are the only group of food service workers on the entire state system of higher education. What used to be 14 campuses, which is now 10. But they're still campuses, but whatever. So still there's technically 14 campuses, but you know what I'm saying. Anyways, because of the consolidation stuff. But they are the only ones without a union after East Stroudsburg unionized last year. So this is wanted to make sure that, you know, these workers at Kutztown University aren't left out in the cold, right, and make sure they get a fair contract. You heard us tell some of these stories on this show, right, on Out to Coop Live and on this show before about their treatment. Food service workers and how they were treated during COVID. And the stories, some of the stories that were pretty freaking horrific, when at the beginning of the pandemic, this is back in 2020, you had workers who were showing up, right? And they were kind of, they were told to self-report, right, any symptoms that they have, right, which is what you want, right? But they did a dual stage check, for example, and this wasn't happening absolutely every single one, but it happened on several of the kind of the major dining services that were open during that time. The food service worker would show up and say, hey, listen, I woke up this morning with these symptoms, right? And you had a manager there that would take their temperature. And at least I've firsthand kind of talking with people about this that happened to them, at least two people. And they said they had a slightly elevated thing. They didn't have like 103 temperature, but they had an elevated temperature over 100 degrees, whatever, like this. Right. Or maybe slightly below that or whatever. And the manager would say, like, okay, go ahead. You can go ahead and go in. Then what the worker had to do is they had to go to an automated one, which would ask him the same questions that the manager just asked them. And so they answer the questions honestly. Have you had any of these symptoms? Yes. Yes. And the manager would, and they would say, look, it's not letting me in. It says that I have to go home. The manager yelled at those workers because he said, I told you you could go in. Why did you answer those questions? Yes. When I already approved you. Right. So the managers wanted to force those workers to go serve students and spend their work day, even though they were flagged as having symptoms. So they wanted the worker to lie about their symptoms to go in. That's just one example, right? And there's many of those things. But even more importantly about this whole set, the whole idea here is to make sure that, and then they didn't have paid sick leave, right? There was no like hazard pay for kind of working in COVID conditions during a pandemic. Nothing like this. We should never allow that to happen. And we know the kind of best way, the easiest way, the most direct way to kind of make sure those things never happen again is to have a union. So get out there on Tuesday, November 16th at 5:30 p.m. 4:30 is going to be a press conference there too as well. Make sure you head on out there and going to support those workers because they deserve a union. They deserve to make sure to have stability in their scheduling. They make sure to have paid sick days. They make sure that they are empowered. They don't have to fear for their job, right, by telling the truth like they did back in the COVID. So good news. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And we come back, we are going to go into this week's last call. I'll try to make this one kind of brief since Sean kind of like skedaddled at the last minute, right? So he had that heart out, which he just found out about. So this is Kevin Mone, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Want to thank you all for kind of supporting the show. Remember, you can help support the show by heading on over to patreon.com/rcpress. Become a patron for as little as $5 a month. While you're sitting here on YouTube, make sure you subscribe to the channel if you're not subscribed already. Like this stream to help it kind of get out there to more people and hit that notification bell so that you know every time that we go live for future shows. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We'll be right back. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull no punches, progressive reporting, and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight. Hey, everybody, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. I am back with you for this week's last call. We talk about kind of random stuff, space stuff, culture stuff, and things like this. Just in kind of space news, brief space news this week. Of course, you got SpaceX kind of launched another 4 astronauts to the International Space Station this week on its Crew 3 mission. This is like the 5th crewed launch in less than 18 months. Because remember, we had a test launch, crewed launch, which was, I forget, it wasn't the Crew 1, it was like, test something. I can't remember what it was. But they launched the astronauts up to the space station, and then they came back. They didn't kind of have a full mission out there. It was just kind of that initial launch. And then they also had a luxury cruise around the planet, right, several times for some kind of really rich folks. So they did that one too as well. Looked ahead to see more of this stuff going forward, folks. It's also going to be interesting to see what happens into this growing space industry when it comes to talking about questions of climate, right? Because, of course, how do rockets get in orbit? It's fossil fuels, folks, right? So that's going to be fascinating to see what happens here, because there's a very, very strong pressures to basically take this, you know, this the birth of this kind of like privatization of space and space industries and just explode it. So we shall see what happens. We also should point out that, you know, this doesn't get a lot of coverage in the US, but the Shenzhou 13 astronauts, those are Chinese astronauts, are basically building their new space station. They're up there right now. We covered it when I think when the initial launch was, when they were planning on doing this. Another module went up, and now you've got these Chinese astronauts that are up there that are kind of assembling a robotic arm and getting things ready to receive additional modules. So that's going to be a second space station. You got to remember that Congress passed laws kind of years ago that forbid the United States to enter into contractual agreements on something like NASA with China. One of the long-term consequences of this is now that Chinese has got its kind of separate and distinct space program, and now they're going to have their separate and distinct space station, right? So instead of this being kind of an opportunity for all nations to kind of know, we're going to kind of have this competition in space right now. There's increasing concerns about some space weapons, which supposedly there may have been some tests conducted on some kind of space weapon systems. China has also launched another satellite, which I haven't mentioned here, that is tasked with cleaning up space junk. And which is, I think it's one of the first of its kind to really go out and try to kind of clean some of that stuff up, which has become increasingly problematic, but is going to need to be cleaned if they hope to expand space programs. The Space Force, yes, Space Force is still a thing, was concerned because they saw that, yes, there's this, you know, satellite that they launched to clean up space junk, but there was a second kind of object that was connected to it that, you know, Space Force is all kind of like worried about, and this is a weapon system, whatever it might be. Nobody really kind of knows what it is. I mean, Chinese obviously know what it is, but that's the kind of back and forth we're going to start to see now, right, when it comes to space. So there's something to look out for. The other thing, which is kind of a fun bit of news, is that, you know, it's actually kind of a really cool experiment, right? So you had these researchers at the Aldrin Space Institute at the Florida Institute of Technology. They're looking at growing crops on other worlds. I don't know how else to put it from that. And so we know the International Space Station, right? They've been starting growing lettuce, right? They've been growing vegetables, and they've having kind of like growing them and harvesting there in these kind of one-shot growth things. And that's been successful. There's been really interesting stuff that's come out of those experiments. What these folks did at the Aldrin Space Institute is they tried to recreate the conditions of Mars soil, right? And actually use like something that was approximates Mars's soil. And what they would have to do in order to grow tomatoes in this case, grow tomatoes in, and to come out with actually not just kind of something that was kind of like a tomato, but a good tomato, right? And, you know, they apparently partnered with Heinz, and they had a successful crop of these tomatoes grown in kind of Martian-like soil under Martian-like conditions, right? That has to do with temperature, that has to do with atmospheric pressure and all that other kind of stuff. And I don't know how they dealt with the gravity thing, though. That I didn't read anything about that. I read a few articles about it, but they didn't really talk about that stuff. So I'd have to actually read the full report. So that was kind of interesting. And so, yep, the Mars edition of Heinz ketchup is out. I have no idea if that's going to be widely available. I don't think it's probably like only a few bottles of it, given the fact it's an experiment. But there was Heinz, and you can click on this stuff in the show notes under Mars edition ketchup, and you'll see Heinz tweeting it out and putting it up on its Instagram. It's a picture of its Mars ketchup bottle. So there you have it. How about that? So That's about all we got for you this week. So a couple of little kind of, I don't know, kind of things to close out today's show is like, number one, this is kind of like a space in like the last call. We were kind of, you know, sneaking stuff around different sci-fi stuff we're watching. We used to do a lot of stuff on reporting on craft beer stuff, but we kind of put a halt to that when there was the kind of exposés that came out around, you know, the kind of deep, deep sexism and sexual harassment and abuse that was taking place in a lot of craft beer industries. And there was a lot of calling out of that stuff. So we put a pause on that because they're like, look, we don't want to even, we weren't saying anything. I used to highlight Free Will Brewing stuff a lot, right? And I still love their beer and all that kind of stuff. But put a little bit of pause on it and say, not saying anything bad about Free Will at all, but just wanted to, you know, the industry should sort this stuff out, right? And we don't even, we didn't want to be even kind of like a passive contributor to that. At that point, so we started just kind of focusing more on some cultural stuff, some TV shows and that kind of thing. And so as you know, if you've been listening to the show and you make it all the way to the last call, you know that I've been working on some D&D campaigns, Dungeons and Dragons campaign, with for my kids, right? And it's really thrilling because I played, let me put it this way, I wish I played more Dungeons and Dragons as a kid. I didn't have friends that were into Dungeons and Dragons that I could even play with. I didn't even, wouldn't even know how to find a game about it at that point. I knew it existed, right? Because there was all these like, right-wing conspiracies back then about Dungeons and Dragons is training your kids to believe in Satan, right? Along with Kiss, right? Whatever. Just, that was the kind of like, you know, same kind of cultural like nonsense going on back then. But, then it became video games and all this stuff. Anyways, so that's been really interesting. And one of the things that happened, I want to give you a little backstory about the show that we're going to have in a couple of weeks. And one of the things that happened was, as I was developing my own campaign, right? I mean, I'm using, the first thing we're going to do is one, it's a preset one from the, from basically like their, one of their intro box sets, right? It's the, which one, why can't I read it here? It's called the starter set, right? So it's called this, it's a campaign. It's called The Lost Mine of Phandalin. Anyway, we'll do that. But then in the meantime, I've been kind of creating my own maps and designing a campaign that I thought was kind of interesting, that was connected to some of these kind of like, you know, issues that we talk about really on this kind of show. And in particular, like I kind of was one of the motivating conflicts that I'm thinking about in my, in the campaign is this idea about, you know, what happens when people begin to manipulate, right? People in power begin to manipulate, groups of people based upon say race or other kinds of, things. Right. So, and part of it has come out of me watching the show called The Dungeon Run, which is did a really interesting job and all this, but anyways, as I was kind of designing these campaigns, or my campaign, and I was reading these kind of like, you know, kind of racial traits of say like an orc or a dwarf or an elf or something like this, I felt uncomfortable with it, you know, just cause it just didn't, I didn't like the way, you know, it was kind of portraying the way this race was this thing completely separate. And you have to live in this way and you feel this way and you think this way. It was really essentialist, right? In the way that how it dealt with kind of some races. And I had heard, right, as I was poking around for different campaigns that there's this book that came out. It's called like, I'll tell you what it is in a minute. It's, here, let me just look it up real fast while I'm sitting here because I've got it. Sources. It is called Tasha's Cauldron of Everything, right? And it is a, it's a new compendium for D&D that was meant to be a little bit disruptive of this kind of essentialist stuff, right? Around kind of race and allow like characters that are more interesting and kind of more diverse, and things like this. And that does it to a certain degree, right? Except it really wasn't explicit about what it was doing, right? It was just kind of like, oh, there's some very cool options and things like this. Well, as I started doing this, as watching the Dungeon Run, they have these side shows and they have these side like campaigns. And there was this group called the, I came across them later. So let me put it this way. So I started looking at, started doing some searches about race and Dungeons and Dragons. Right. And to see what, and it was like all this cool stuff. I like couldn't believe it. And it was like, and like people really thinking through in the wake of the murder of George Floyd and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, people who loved the game for a long period of time and people who were, well, the new things, they said, people who loved the game for a long time started thinking about kind of, well, you know, bringing up all these questions about how we think about race and kind of racist essentialism. We love this game and it talks about race and how do we make sense of this, right? And do some really critical thinking about this on these message boards and think about alternatives to how they talk about race and stuff. The second thing that happened with COVID was that you had an explosion of people, a renewed interest in Dungeons and Dragons, right? So that both with these YouTube shows that went on that kind of followed it, that you saw a huge uptick of this, and then people looking for things to do that where they could still interact with each other and kind of like have these kind of social, really kind of engaging and interesting moments doing this stuff online, and a new generation of folks are joining D&D. That happened at the same time that as a result of D&D 5e, the fifth edition, which kind of made all these kind of complicated rules a little bit more streamlined compared to past. Now, some people hate that, but whatever. But it made it a little more streamlined, more accessible for new people, right? So that was all going in with this explosion of it. Then you have COVID-19 and then you have Black Lives Matter, all the stuff that's going on. So in the midst of all that stuff, right, I kept on coming across, people kept on pointing out this one book, right, for D&D. And it was published last year by this little press. I'm going to hold it up. It's called Arcanus Press. Right. And it's written by Gwendolyn Marshall, and who's also a co-owner of Arcanus Press. Right. Now, Gwendolyn Marshall also happens to be a philosophy professor at the Florida International University in Miami. Right. And people kept pointing to this, and it won all these awards around diversity. And what's amazing about this little book, right? It's like 70 pages long. It's got a whole campaign in it. Right. A kind of you could incorporate it into existing campaigns. But it talks about like the why, right? Why do we need to be critical about race? Why use ancestry and culture instead of race as a way of thinking about our characters, right? And it goes to this kind of essentialism on race and how we know there was no scientific basis in the past. Now, granted, yes, this is fictional and all this kind of stuff, but these are the discourses we inhabit, right? And or kids can inhabit, and just in terms of like a unconscious way of thinking about race, right? They're just kind of trying to find the rules of the game and play this stuff out, whatever. Doesn't mean it's kind of racist in the kind of like overt way, but it's embedded with assumptions about race, right? And so this book works to open that up, right? It's just absolutely fascinating. So I reached out to Gwen Marshall about this, and she's going to be on the show on November 22nd to talk about this and say this tabletop gaming kind of more expansively. The other thing I want to say about this, and I didn't know this at the time because the book, when I was trying to kind of track down the author, right? And the book is, you know, authored, right, was here as Eugene Marshall, right? But she has recently come out now as trans, like as a trans woman. And it's Gwen Marshall now, right? So we're having ours, you know, Gwen Marshall. And so she recently attended a gaming convention in Wisconsin. And it was her first kind of like coming to one of these conventions kind of as an out trans woman, right? And so we're going to talk a little bit about that too as well. And you could see the way that these questions of identity and race and culture and sexuality and stuff get kind of all happen in this stuff. I'm someone also, one of the things that I teach, right, is I'm teaching a class right now, actually, it's called New Media Story and Change. It's looking at the role of storytelling, right, in building social movements, right? And a lot of what happens in this kind of storytelling, right, especially when you're doing collective storytelling, right, is that we're rehearsing and practicing particular ways of engaging in the world. And of course, that's how we learn as humans, right? Kids, they learn not just by kind of like, you know, like go study in a book and repeat it on a test. They learn by inhabiting the world around them through play, right? And that's a lot of the ways kind of identities are built and kind of thoughts are built in terms of the way that they kind of play and interact with the world. Not in this explicit instruction kind of stuff, but in this kind of world of play that is much more engaged. And it happens through the gamings. We see this happen as a parallel. If you look at what's happened in the video game industry, right? We know what happened when the video game industry became dominated by these kind of like, you know, first person shootout stuff, right? Very masculinist, kind of toxic masculinity kind of dominated a lot of the kind of gaming circles, which became brutal and exclusive for women, right? But also became pretty racist spaces, which not too long ago, right? Over the past decade, the alt-right, right, the right wing in this country exploited those spaces. And they looked for ways of exploiting where you saw a lot of kids, especially kind of white young boys, right, who felt marginalized for whatever reason in the world. You know, because, you know, kids have difficulty, they're adolescents, they're growing up in the world, and they feel it. But looking for turning that sense of kind of being on the outside of something and turning them towards white nationalism, sexism, misogyny, and all this other stuff. And the alt-right built communities around this. And we see its worldly expression in people like the Groypers and people like the Proud Boys. They all come out of that kind of milieu. And Andrew Breitbart, right, who did Breitbart News, and of course Steve Bannon writes about the same thing. They talk about the ways that politics is downstream from culture. Now, we could problematize that a little bit and kind of really think about what if we agree with that. But there is definitely a way, an influence at least there, where when you see these kind of cultural shifts, it has impacts on politics. The progressives in the left virtually ignored what was happening in the gaming circles for the most part. I mean, I don't want to be, there were women speaking out about this. I remember she came out and kind of like was kind of exposing the sexism and the misogyny and the movements and stuff. She did some really cool stuff there. There were women that were speaking out. There were people kind of on the margins, but that kind of made their way in, especially when you have people like Milo Yiannopoulos, you know, kind of get aboard the whole Gamergate stuff and everything like that. So anyways, that's a long way around say that was a context that happened, right, in this other kind of like gaming space. And again, am I saying that tabletop role-playing games are the same identical thing? I'm saying no. But I'm also saying that people who are invested in these communities, right, who are built into these communities that they're part of, right, especially when storytelling and character and identity are really at the core of a lot of this, you know, the participation – to see the folk, like a not just this book, Ancestry and Culture, but to see a lot of folks in the kind of message boards and stuff like that being openly talking about, you know, how to kind of like create these spaces for multicultural democracy, multiculturalism and diversity, right? This kind of expression of identity in a positive way that's filled with justice, not hate. That is amazing. And so that's why I want to talk about it, right? And I also thought about, you know, look, I know I've heard more and more kind of like young kids who've been getting involved with Dungeons and Dragons, right? And this is one of these spaces that you kind of attracts a lot of kind of young white boys, but increasingly, this is like the coolest thing about it, right? Of young girls too as well are getting involved in these spaces, right? So as parents, right, knowing that that's kind of happening and is an option out there, what would it look like for us to be paying attention to this stuff too as well, right? I'm certainly thinking that as a parent, as I'm designing this campaign, thinking like, hey, this is a space where we could actually kind of role play in a way that is kind of like not kind of like strictly limited by the external stuff, but we can also problematize and put this as a problem, what happens when these factors are used against it. So it's a really cool space to kind of be thinking about this stuff. So that's what we're going to have there. So that's something my little kind of out the coop last call for this week about why we're going to have one of the many reasons we're going to have Gwen Marshall on November 2nd to or 22nd to talk about her book and some of the broader stuff around gaming more generally. Also a reminder that on this Monday, November 15th at 7 p.m., we'll have Laura Putnam on the show. We're going to talk about the PA elections. We're going to be talking about the growing progressive left movements in Western PA around Pittsburgh and the surrounding suburbs. And we're looking at her article, Rust Belt and Transition, looking at some of that history. She actually is, you know, she's a professor of history at University of Pittsburgh. Some of that history about what kind of like caused this kind of first separation between, say, progressive politics and, you know, a particular segment of the working class within Pittsburgh, and what accounts for the organizing, something that accounts for its kind of return. So we'll be talking about that on Monday, November 15th at 7 p.m. Also want to give one last shout out. Make sure that you're out there on November 16th at Kutztown University's campus in front of South Dining Hall at 5:30 for a rally with KU dining workers or food service workers. There'll be a press conference, I believe, at 4:30 kind of before that too as well, which should be a kind of a good show. She'll be out there too as well. Anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Thank you all for sticking with us. Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Emily, for the comments kind of in this section. We look forward to kind of the struggle ahead. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. I don't know what I should say. I don't know if about all of you out there, but it's a super, super rainy day. Super, super rainy day here. And I know it is a bunch of other places, so hope you stay dry. Still hope you have a good weekend and you're getting ready for kind of the week ahead of us. Stay in the fight, everybody. Look forward to it. Until then,
see ya!